Next case we've got here is docket number 64201, Marquez v. State of Nevada. All right. Mr. Abitangelo, good morning, and are you ready to go?
Yes.
Okay, come on up.
Go ahead.
May it please the Court, Tony Abitangelo on behalf of Mr. Marquez, the appellant, justices, opposing counsel. Our brief is based upon a due process violation that occurred at the district court level. The main issues that we have presented substantially shorten or take away his due process rights of the lower court reviewing the entire record prior to his for a hearing for a confession, which was videotaped. The judge at the lower court level stated in the record she did not review the videotape.
She did read the transcript, though.
That is correct, Justice.
And she indicated that she did read the transcript.
And we would concede that fact, absolutely. However, the video shows completely different things than reading a transcript. The video, when you watch it, for example,
Mr. Abitangelo, before you start getting into the video, let me come back as to the video. Review of the pleadings below. It's not asserted what in the video makes it any different or why the video would cast a different view of the proceedings than just reviewing the transcript. That's one of the concerns. I understand sometimes the video demonstrates things that clearly a cold transcript doesn't. But in this case, the record seems to be silent as to asserting what specifically in that video would give a different texture or a different feel.
And that's where we're going to go with this, is that, first of all, when you watch the video, the detective and the defendant at the time, Mr. Marquez, are not sitting across a table from each other. They're sitting side by side. So if Mr. Marquez wanted to leave, as stated, you're free to go at any time, he couldn't leave.
Did Mr. Marquez ever, my understanding of the video is that Mr. Marquez never attempted to get up or to gather his material or anything else. There was no restraint by the officer. So
he was physically blocked from leaving, and he said, I'm done. He made an affirmative statement stating, I would like to leave.
Was there any movement?
If you watch the video, there is minimum movement. He is sitting in a practically like a frozen state. The video shows, after he says he's lost control, that the detective keeps asking questions. There's numerous pages of no responses. The video will show silence, whether it's 2 seconds, 20 seconds. It shows that he's sitting there frozen, and his free will has been overborne, because he's already stated to the detective 3 times he wants to leave. And he stated twice, well, once he said, I'm losing control. The second time he said, I've lost control. So therefore, there's nothing voluntary about the statement.
Did the jury see the videotape?
My understanding is they did not. It was submitted as evidence, but my understanding is the jury did not review the video, and the video was not presented in the course of the trial. I think from looking at the transcript, from looking at the audio and the video, that a reasonable person would see he was not free to leave. He had lost control. He did not have capacity for self-determination. Also, what is also needs to be examined is this: where this interview took place. The interview took place within the confines of Metropolitan Police Department substation. In the substation, you have to have a key card to get in the back. It's also stated in the record he has to be escorted around in the background of the, once you're inside the Metropolitan Police Department. He's not free to go and roam around. He is not free to leave on his own. That is our main issues at the video, his statements, where he said 3 times that he would come back another day. There's no relinquishing of questioning, no relinquishing of anything by the detective. Once again, Mr. Marquez states, can I come back another day? Detective doesn't ignore it. He just ignores it because, according to the detective, the defendant has not used, or the appellant, has not used the magic words as quoted, I'm done, I don't want to talk to you, I'd like to leave. He's made, Marquez has made affirmative statements, and he tries it a third time. And yet still no response by the detective, except for more questions, stay here, we're close to getting this resolved, tell me, I won't tell anybody else. All that is in the transcript. Every message was made and every attempt was given by Mr. Marquez to say he was done. And then once he's out of control, to me, that's when the interview has got to stop. I don't care if it's a porter, as mentioned in some of the Pacima references by the state, an educated individual, an uneducated individual, a person who's out of control is not able to make a free and voluntary confession. And after Mr. Marquez says he was out of control, is when the admissions were made against his interest. Are there any other issues the court would like me to address?
The psychological, request for the psychological examination of the alleged victim.
Yes, the Abbott case has the three-prong approach. The state did not use the psychological examination in that case. So the other two prongs, in my view, are the ones that are really in favor of the defense and the appellant. The veracity of the alleged victim is the one is one prong. In that prong, looking at what was stated at the preliminary hearing, numerous counts were dismissed. Our briefs also reflect the numerous inconsistencies that were stated. Another prong of the Abbott test is corroboration. Once again, in our briefs, there are numerous issues in which nothing is corroborated. There is also no independent evidence. There is no same exam. There is no any other physical evidence that presented to corroborate the victim's story. There was also statements made by the defendant that the state refers to, but once again, those statements were made after Mr. Marquez said he was out of control. There's statements by the victim were very inconsistent. Hence, at the Justice Court level, 15 counts were dismissed.
Now, the state didn't put on any expert testimony about her. That's correct.
They
put Chambers on about confessions.
Yeah,
course, confessions.
That is correct, Your Honor. That's why the first prong of the Abbott test, we cannot fight.
Uh-huh.
We have to concede that issue.
You want to talk about jury instructions 19 and 20, I think they are. Yeah, 19 and 20.
Yes, Justice Douglas. The first instruction, 19, in and of itself is a good instruction. When you read instruction number 20, which basically states the Miranda warning is a prophylactic measure, which ensures that the defendant has the ability to give a confession or not incriminate himself. You tie those two together, and when the judge, the presiding officer of the jury trial, is saying that this is a free and voluntary confession, why does the jury then have to go back to 19? Because it's already coming into evidence when they're hearing it. So to me, when you read those two together, 20 erodes number 19. So the jury is thinking, well, the judge who's in charge here and understands what's going on with the rules of law, therefore it's a voluntary confession and Miranda counts, and therefore we don't have to really look at all the examinations in number 19.
I'm still going back to the issue as to why this would be considered an involuntary statement. And then I think you've indicated several aspects. What do you think is your strongest point in that regard?
The reason it's involuntary primarily comes down to Mr. Marquez saying, I'm out of control. He is not in his full faculty. And when you watch the video, he's sitting there and he's not responding. There's numerous questions. Like we said in the transcript, there's like 6 to 8 pages minimum of question after question with zero response. He's sitting there frozen, pinned in the corner of a room with a detective asking him questions. And he's not responding.
But at no time did he state, I'm not speaking, I'm invoking my right to remain silent, I want an attorney.
He did not use those magic words. He did not specifically say that. He did say an affirmative statement, I will come back another day.
But isn't that, I mean, under Dewey, yeah, you've got to have an unambiguous, unequivocal statement that you're done, I want my attorney, I want to invoke my right to remain silent. Why wouldn't we have to consider this statement that I want to continue this on another day as being equivocal and contrary to Dewey?
Because the difference is he was supposedly free to go. The detective did nothing to assist him to leave. The detective had him pinned to the corner. Once again, they're not across the table as we're viewing each other. They're parallel to each other. And Mr. Marquez, to leave, has to push by, walk around, get past the detective. He's not free to go. So if he really truly was free to leave, and then when he says, I will come back another day, and he's in a, let's say he's in a social environment where he could just get up and he could go and walk away, he could do that. But he is not free to leave. He is now pushed into the corner, and by saying, I will come back another day, he's making an affirmative statement. I'm done. Then he says, can I come back another day? There's no maybe, yes, you can come back another day. No, it's question, more examination, more interrogation. Then he says it a third time. Every message was conveyed that this gentleman was done discussing the case. He's sitting there silently for minutes upon minutes. He did every, it's hair splitting to me. If you have to use certain magic words, he said everything but the magic word of I need my attorney.
And so how do we view that? Under what standard? Is that a factual determination as to whether or not it was equivocal or unequivocal? Go ahead.
I think it's absolutely factual. Every type of situation with a Miranda statement is a case-by-case basis. And what do they say? In common sense, let alone the words that are used, give you every indication as a detective or an officer, this gentleman's ready to go or he's not ready to leave. Or he's ready to continue talking. He doesn't want to continue talking. Not every single person knows the Miranda rights. He said, I will concede that the detective read the Miranda rights, but saying, I want to leave, I want to come back another day, that conveys the message, I'm done. I'm ready to leave. And he can't leave because he's in a secure area, pinned in a corner, and he's not free to go.
But there was a motion to suppress, and during hearing, or I guess part of the findings was that there wasn't a violation of Miranda because there wasn't an invocation of his right to remain silent or his request to have an attorney. And so you've just indicated that that's a factual finding, and don't we have to give deference to the district court in that
I never instance? Saw findings of fact and conclusion of law written down by the lower court judge. And it was also not a thorough review of all the evidence. The evidence that was missed is a substantial part of this case, the video.
Is there a specific legal authority as to the necessity to review all material, or whether in this case, because again, there's nothing that was asserted down below that says, if you look at the video, you will see this, this, and this, which is not clearly reflected in the transcript.
I believe that was the Curtin case, Your Honor, I had.
Because the distinction here is that the court says we reviewed it. And since nothing was being pointed out by counsel down below as to there being a distinction, why should we consider it at this point?
And the United States versus Curtin, the district court admitted to being unable to read the stories because they were so disturbing. I thought this problem overnight because I want to address the relative overwhelming prejudice versus the purpose. I read the first story and a little bit of the second. That's as far as I could get. The holding in that court was it was not a review, thorough review of the entire record.
But again, in this case, they reviewed the entire transcript from down below without an assertion of what would be different if they view the tape opposed to reading the transcript. That's the concern we have.
And I understand that.
And defense attorney could have presented the video at the motion to suppress.
And I was not the attorney of record, and that's not being done for speculation, that I can't go back and assist on. I know that we started a jury instruction case that's substantial error with the Green case. But the concern is getting the full and fair due process rights of Mr. Marquez in place regarding the understanding of exactly what happened.
Well, I think the defendant will be able to raise that as to ineffective assistance of counsel on the habeas corpus down the line, if we do affirm.
Thank you, Mr. Abitangelo. Appreciate your argument. Okay. Mr. Tonello, you ready?
I am, thank you.
You addressed a couple of these issues. We'll just get right to the point.
You betcha. I guess I'm lucky because I get to hear a little bit with Mr. Abitangelo having a chance to go first. So I'll just address some of these issues. Pete Sinnell for the respondent. Thank you for having me here. Thank you to counsel. Mr. Abitangelo is somebody I like and respect. It's a pleasure to be here with him as well. Let me just jump right in. First of all, the jury did see this video. This is my case. This is a trial that I did. I know this very much because I remember spending hours before the actual trial preparing so the jury could read the transcript as they watched the video on two different screens. So the jury both saw the transcript contemporaneous to watching the video. So the jury saw the video. Additionally, the judge saw the video as well. And as something we pointed out in our brief, if the judge, upon seeing the video, found it to be different than the transcript that she had reviewed, something that was outside of something that she thought that it should be, the judge had a chance at that point to sua sponte, stop things and say, you know, I need to readdress this situation. And let me just say this. The defense attorney on the case, Ms. Violet Rodasta, has been, I think, a decade on the what we call the sex team at the public defender's office. A very, very accomplished attorney. I've done many cases against her. She's a very smart attorney. I think she was smart in the sense of not pushing the judge to watch this video. Because this video, I guess Mr. Abitangelo and I are going to have to differ because I've seen this video a dozen times. And Detective LaFreniere, I can say this with all confidence, I've had many cases, he is one of the most calm, quiet, soft-spoken detectives I've ever seen. I mean, so when he brings him in and when you watch this video, there isn't this yelling, there isn't this leaning forward, there isn't this drilling. It's a very quiet, calm conversation. And granted, they're in a room, but it's an unlocked room. We heard testimony about that. The room is not locked. The man, Mr. Marquez, came. He brought of his own accord, came of his own accord. You see it right away in the record where he tells me you're free to leave at any point. And if you watch the video, Mr. Marquez never stands up, never tries to leave anything along those lines. So this video, as you watch it, and you watch Detective LaFreniere talking about this and asking these questions, there's no sense of kind of this pressure, no sense of this kind of this pushiness. Now, Mr. Abitangelo does bring up a few points as to when he talks about control. I would just point out that on page 83 of the, if we go to the transcript, if you look at what the interpreter, and it gets a little confusing because in the transcript you have both the interpreter's statement and then it's also been translated by the person who's typing up the transcript, so you kind of get it twice. But if you look at what the interpreter said, who was sitting there in the room, the interpreter interprets Mr. Marquez as saying, I'm just not in control of things. The way she's going around saying things. To the state, that paints a very different picture than I'm out of control, or I've lost control, as to whether he's lost control mentally or lost control bodily, you know, can't, where his will has been overborne, where he wouldn't be able to personally go forward in the right headspace, so to speak. And this, the interpreter, I mean, what it says right there is, I've lost control of the situation in the sense that he now realizes, oh, this, you know, I'm being asked about this, is nervous.
Now, let me ask you, another point Mr. Abitangelo made was that he had requested on several occasions that he come back on another day.
All right, and I appreciate that. On a couple of occasions, he does say, and I wrote these down exactly, his statements were, I apologize, I want to make sure, why don't I come back on another day and we talk more comfortably, and I will come by on another day.
Was that before or after he was Mirandized?
This is after. Miranda was right at the beginning. And after Miranda, they discuss, you know, they talk about different things, family, you remember these people. I mean, obviously, the detective doesn't just jump right in and start accusing him. I mean, it takes some time to shape this and talk about it. Now, when he does say, why don't I come back on another day, we talk more comfortably, what we're talking about here is this is, and Your Honor kind of brought it up before, this is not a clear invocation of silence. He doesn't say, I'm not going to talk about this. In fact, if anything, if you look at the statement on its face, it's, I'll talk about this on another day.
But remaining silent doesn't necessarily mean he's going to leave. In other words, not that I'm trying to bolster your position, but once he's Mirandized, I mean, all bets are off. There's no reason that he's forced to leave. If he wants to leave, they can arrest him right then and there. Because he's been Mirandized, then they can keep going with the questioning until he says, I want an attorney or I don't want to say anything anymore. But this leaving thing is like a red herring to me, having been involved in confessions almost my whole career as a public defender and as a judge. And it's not to help you out.
Yeah,
you're going a way that I don't think you need to.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. And I agree. I mean, it's – and within the context – I mean, also, if you watch the context of it, I mean, as I've said, I've seen this many times, there's no movement of, I'm standing up, I'm trying to leave, anything along those lines.
Once he's Mirandized, you can either – I want a lawyer, you have to stop, or I want to remain silent, you have to stop. And he's got two choices, and he didn't either, as far as I can see from the transcript.
And that's exactly correct. He does neither of those throughout the entire
And then my understanding, in addition to the ruling that the district court judge made – you just indicated that the jurors did get to see the video.
Yes.
And in accord with instruction 19, they got to make the determination whether or not it was a voluntary confession.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And their determination obviously was that it was.
That's correct. And it was something, just to touch on that, I appreciate Mr. Abitangelo's kind of his interpretation of 19 when it's added to 20, but as somebody who was there, I can comfortably say that's just not something anybody in that room was thinking of in that interpretation of it, because if you look at the arguments of counsel, my co-counsel on the case in closing never even comes close to making any kind of argument that because he was Mirandized, that's the end of it. In fact, his argument in closing was, look at everything, look at the totality, look how this, I mean, he asked them to look at everything. Ms. Rodasta does a very, very good job in her closing, discussing, going into great detail as to, you know, look at these factors. And then in my rebuttal, again, I don't even touch on, you should only, you know, he was Mirandized and that's the end of how you should look at this. That's never anything that was even, I don't think anybody even thought of it that way. And so it's an interpretation by Mr. Abitangelo that I don't think is born through the record.
Was the video shown at the motion to suppress, though?
No, I was not there. I was not the counsel at the time. But from everything I've seen, it was not. I'd be very shocked if it was. And I can't say affirmatively 100%, but I'm about 99.9%.
You know why it wouldn't have been shown by the state, or by the defense, or by the judge saying, let's look at the video?
If the judge wanted to, or if defense asked, at that point, I mean, Ms. Rodasta could have said, Your Honor, I'd like you to go back and watch this video, or, you know, we can watch the video right now. I believe that was all in play, but it had been submitted, the motion, and the judge had read the transcript, and it was left at that. And she was never instructed that she needed to go beyond that to watch the video, and so I don't think it was ever pushed.
What about the request for the independent psychological examination?
Well, we have this is something that the legislature even recently has kind of looked to do away with completely. I mean, it's something that I think needs to be used in very specific cases. I've worked on a certain team where I dealt with children. It was about 2 years that I was on that team. And with these kinds of cases, it's something that I think the court needs to look at and really follow those steps. And so with the Abbott case, gives us those three prongs. And that first prong is the state never called an expert. In fact, it was defense who called an expert. They called Dr. Chambers. We didn't call any experts. If you look at the second prong of Abbott on that as to whether there's corroboration, there was. In fact, there was specific corroboration coming from the defendant himself in his statement with Detective Lafreniere. So this wasn't only her statements and nothing else whatsoever. Now, it is true, there wasn't a sane exam, there wasn't things of that nature, but when there's been delayed disclosure, which happens in a lot of cases, years later, there's no purpose to it. You can't do those kinds of things. But the corroboration is there in the defendant's statements. And then in the third prong, as to her mental state, I can't vouch, obviously, as an attorney, but I mean, I spent time with her, and I also know in the preliminary hearing stage, counts do get dismissed at times, because when you have a child who's been, I mean, for lack of a better term, who's been molested for years and years by a stepfather, boyfriend of the mother, somebody like that, when this has been going on for years, it's very difficult, especially when they disclose years later, it's difficult to kind of hone those into very specific events, because it's just such a huge part of things that happen. And that's what happens at preliminary hearings sometimes, and the judge says that's just not specific enough, and removes some of the other ones that are just hazy enough so that we're left with kind of the more specific ones. And that's what happened here in this case.
You think that first prong of Abbott trumps the other two prongs?
I do. In fact, in my humble opinion in my reading of Abbott, I mean, that's really kind of where it starts, is did the state do this? And then we follow on to the other prongs. But the state did not try to...
But that gives state too much control, because in this situation we have, on the side, we have the mother stating that there was an abusive relation, which might have spilled over to the child, and the child witnessed it. So it does bring into play state of mind somewhat.
Yes, somewhat, but I mean, I don't know a better way to say it than in every case, it can be said, or you can always come up with something that this child, you know, lied before, or, you know what, he wasn't nice to mom. I mean, that it's the kind of thing that can always be brought forward as far as a possibility, but when we're really kind of getting into the mental states, to have a child undergo a psychological examination when one is not being proffered by the state, first of all, and then to say that just because of those small factors that it has to go forward, I just don't think it rises to that.
So when you're talking about putting someone in jail for a period of time, it might need to rise to that sometimes.
And I'm not saying it never should. I understand, Your Honor. Thank you.
Can you address one more thing for me?
Yes.
Counsel had indicated, at least in the briefing, that this confession was coerced through deception. And that the way it was indicated was that the detective promised confidentiality. And why isn't that deception? And is that exactly what was indicated by the detective, that this is a confidential conversation?
And it was not what was indicated by the detective. Let me just reiterate, he was Mirandized at the beginning, meaning that he'd been told that anything you say can and will be used against you. Not saying that blankets any misdeed later, but we start there. Now, if you get to the actual statement, what he says, and this is, I mean, it's not, I know in the brief it talks about psychological warfare, but what we're really talking about is a conversation. And a lot of times when somebody's folded their arms and they're just kind of looking, they have to talk. Now, as part of his talking through with the detective, he does say, you know, when I brought this, I didn't call your girlfriend and tell your girlfriend. I didn't tell her. I didn't go around telling everybody about what you did. You know, I'm not putting this blast notice on everybody that what you've done. And that's what he says. He never says, this is between us. This is you and I. I'm not telling anybody about this. It's within the context. If you look at the context, it's very clear. I didn't tell your girlfriend about this. And it, obviously, he's trying to gain the trust with him. I mean, I think that's pretty clear. And he's trying to establish some trust so that he will, you know, talk to him more about this. But within the context, it's not a confidentiality that he's given.
Okay. Thank you for clearing that up.
I guess I have 3 more minutes. If there's any other questions, I'm happy to address any of them.
Any questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank you for the experience and for the time.
Absolutely. And counsel, we appreciate the briefing in this case. It was good, and the arguments were good. Thank you for being here. This case will stand submitted, and this court will stand in recess until...